Thus, we now turn our attention to the question of how voters try to influence the position of candidates and where the candidates will end up. One way to help keep your vote from getting lost in the crowd is to make it stand out. Take an extreme position away from the crowd. Someone who thinks that the country is too liberal could vote for a moderately conservative candidate. Or she could go all the way to the extreme right and support Rush Limbaugh, should he run. To the extent that candidates compromise by taking central positions, it may be in some voters' interests to appear more extreme than they are. This tactic is effective only up to a point. If you go overboard, you are thought of as a crackpot, and the result is that your opinion is ignored. The trick is to take the most extreme stand consistent with appearing rational. To make this a little more precise, imagine that we can align all the candidates on a 0 to 100 scale of liberal to conservative. The Green Party is way on the left, around 0, while Rush Limbaugh takes the most conservative stance, somewhere near 100. Voters express their preference by picking some point along the spectrum. Suppose the winner of the election is the candidate whose position is the average of all voters' positions. The way you might think of this happening is that, through negotiations and compromises, the leading candidate's position is chosen to reflect the average position of the electorate. The parallel in bargaining is to settle disputes by offering to split the difference. Consider yourself a middle-of-the-roader. If it were in your hands, you would prefer a candidate who stands at the position 50 on our scale. But it may turn out that the country is a bit more conservative than that. Without you, the average is 60. For concreteness, you are one of 100 voters polled to determine the average position. If you state your actual preference, the candidate will move to 99 times 60 plus 50 divided by 100 equals 59.9. If instead you exaggerate and claim you want 0, the final outcome will be at 59.4. By exaggerating your claim, you are 6 times as effective in influencing the candidate's position. Here, extremism in the defense of liberalism is no vice. Of course, you won't be the only one doing this. All those more liberal than 60 will be claiming to be at 0, while those more conservative will be arguing for 100. In the end, everyone will appear to be polarized, although the candidate will still take some central position. The extent of the compromise will depend on the relative numbers pushing in each direction. The problem with this averaging approach is that it tries to take into account both intensity and direction of preferences. People have an incentive to tell the truth about direction, but exaggerate when it comes to intensity. The same problem arises with split the difference. If that is the rule for settling disputes, everyone will begin with an extreme position. One solution to this problem is related to Harold Hoetling's observation discussed in Chapter 9, that political parties will converge to the median voter's position. No voter will take an extreme position if the candidate follows the preferences of the median voter. That is, he chooses the platform where there are exactly as many voters who want the candidate to move left as to move right. Unlike the mean, the median position does not depend on the intensity of the voters' preferences, only their preferred direction. To find the median point, a candidate could start at 0 and keep moving to the right as long as a majority supports this change. At the median, the support for any further rightward movement is exactly balanced by the equal number of voters who prefer a shift left. When a candidate adopts the median position, no voter has an incentive to distort her preferences. Why? There are only 3 cases to consider. 1. A voter to the left of the median. 2. A voter exactly at the median. And 3. A voter to the right of the median. In the first case, exaggerating preferences leftward does not alter the median, and therefore the position adopted, at all. The only way that this voter can change the outcome is to support a move rightward. But this is exactly counter to his interest. In the second case, the voter's ideal position is being adopted anyway, and there is nothing to gain by a distortion of preferences. The third case parallels the first. Moving more to the right has no effect on the median, while voting for a move left is counter to the voter's interests. The way the argument was phrased suggested that the voter knows the median point for the voting population and whether she is to the right or the left of it. Yet the incentive to tell the truth had nothing to do with which of those outcomes occurred. You can think about all three of the above cases as possibilities and then realize that whichever outcome materializes, the voter will want to reveal her position honestly. The advantage of the rule that adopts the median position is that no voter has an incentive to distort her preferences. Truthful voting is the dominant strategy for everyone. The only problem with adopting the median voter's position is its limited applicability. This option is available only when everything can be reduced to a one-dimensional choice, as in liberal versus conservative. But not all issues are so easily classified. Once voters' preferences are more than one-dimensional, there will not be a median, and this neat solution no longer works. Why the Constitution Works. Warning. The material in this section is hard, even for a trip to the gym. We include it because it provides an example of how game theory helps us understand why the U.S. Constitution has proved so durable. The fact that the result is based on research from one of your authors might also play some small part. We said that things got much more complicated when the candidate positions can no longer be ordered along a single dimension. We turn now to the case where the electorate cares about two issues, say taxes and social issues. When everything was one-dimensional, the candidate's position could be represented by a score from 0 to 100, which you can think of as a position on a line. Now the candidate's position on these two issues can be represented as a point in a plane. If there are three issues that matter, then the candidates would have to be located in a three-dimensional space, which is much harder to draw in a two-dimensional book. We represent a candidate's position on each of the two issues by where he or she is located. As drawn, the incumbent, I, is middle of the road, slightly liberal on taxes and slightly conservative on social issues. In contrast, the challenger, C, has taken a very conservative position on both taxes and social issues. Each voter can be thought of as being located at a point in space. The location is the voter's most preferred position. Voters have a simple rule. They vote for the candidate who is closest to their preferred position. Our next diagram illustrates how the votes will be divided between the two candidates. All those to the left will vote for the incumbent, and those to the right will vote for the challenger. Now that we've explained the rules of the game, where do you imagine the challenger will want to locate? And if the incumbent is smart enough to best position herself to fend off the challenger, where will she start out? Note that as the challenger moves closer to the incumbent, he picks up some votes but loses none. For example, the move from C to C star expands the group of voters who prefer C. The dividing line is now the dashed line. That is because anyone who prefers the challenger's position to the incumbent's also prefers something halfway between the two to the incumbent's. Likewise, a person who prefers a $1 gas tax to no tax is also likely to prefer a 50-cent tax to no tax. What this means is that the challenger has the incentive to locate right next to the incumbent, coming at the incumbent from a direction where there are the most voters. In the picture on the following page, the challenger would come at the incumbent directly from the northeast. The challenge for the incumbent is much like the famous cake-cutting problem. In the cake-cutting problem, there are two kids who have to share a cake. The question is to develop a procedure for them to divide it up so as to ensure that each feels he has gotten at least half of the cake. The solution is, I cut, you choose. One kid cuts the cake while the other chooses. This gives the first child an incentive to cut the cake as evenly as possible. Since the second kid has a choice of halves, he will not feel cheated. This problem is a bit different. Here, the challenger gets to cut the cake and to choose. But the incumbent gets to stake out a position that the challenger has to cut through. For example, if all of the voters are uniformly located in a disc, then the incumbent can position herself right in the center. However the challenger tries to position himself in relation to the incumbent can still attract half the voters. In the figure that follows, the dashed line represents a challenger coming from the northwest. The disk is still split in two. The center of the disk is always closest to at least half the points in the disk. The situation is more complicated if voters are uniformly located in a triangle. For simplicity, we leave off the issue axes. Now, where should the incumbent position herself, and what is the greatest number of votes that she can assure herself of? In the picture below, the incumbent has positioned herself poorly. If the challenger were to approach from either the left or the right, the incumbent can still attract support from half the voters. But were the challenger to approach from below, she can garner well more than half the votes. The incumbent would have done better to have positioned herself lower down to preempt this attack. It turns out that locating at the average point in the set, what is known as the center of gravity, will guarantee the incumbent at least 4/9 of the total vote. The incumbent will attract 2/3 of the vote in each of two dimensions for a total of 2/3 times 2/3 equal 4/9. You can see in the figure below that we've divided the triangle up into 9 smaller triangles, each a mini-me of the larger one. The center of gravity of the triangle is where the 3 lines intersect. It is also the preferred position of the average voter. By locating at the center of gravity, the incumbent can guarantee herself support from voters in at least 4 of the 9 triangles. For example, the challenger can attack from straight below and capture all of the voters in the bottom 5 triangles. If we extend this to a triangle in 3 dimensions, then the incumbent still does best by locating at the center of gravity, but now can be guaranteed only 3/4 times 3/4 times 3/4 equals 27/64 of the vote. A rather surprising finding is that the triangle, and its multidimensional analogs, turns out to be the worst possible result for the incumbent across all convex sets in any number of dimensions. A set is convex if for any 2 points in the set, the line connecting them is also in the set. Thus, a disk and a triangle are convex, while the letter T is not. Now for the real surprise. Across all convex sets, the incumbent, by locating at the center of gravity, can guarantee herself at least 1 divided by E equals 1 divided by 2.71828, which is about 36% of the vote. The result even holds when voters are normally distributed, like a bell curve, rather than uniform. What that means is that if a 64% majority is required to dislodge the status quo, then it is possible to find a stable outcome by picking the point that is the average of all the voters' preferences. No matter the challenger's position, the incumbent is able to attract at least 36% of the vote and thus remain in place. All that is required is that the distribution of voter preferences isn't too extreme. It is okay for some people to take extreme positions so long as there are relatively more people in the middle, as arises with the normal distribution. The incumbent could be a policy or a precedent, not just a politician. This might then explain the stability of the U.S. Constitution. If all it took was a simple majority, 50%, to amend the Constitution, it could spin around in cycles. But as it requires more than a 64% majority, namely a 2/3 vote, then there is some position that is undefeatable against all comers. That doesn't mean any status quo would be undefeated by all other alternatives. It means that there is some status quo, namely the average position in the voter population, which can't be beaten according to a 67-33 vote. We want a majority rule that is small enough to allow for flexibility or change when preferences change, but not so small as to create instability. A simple majority rule is the most flexible, but is too flexible. It has the potential for cycles and instability. At the other extreme, a 100% or unanimity rule would eliminate cycles but lock in the status quo. The goal is to pick the smallest majority size that ensures a stable outcome. It looks like two-thirds majority rule is just on the right side of 64% to do the trick. The U.S. Constitution got it right. We appreciate that this all went a bit quickly. The results here are based on the research of Andrew Kaplan, done jointly with Barry Nailbuff. All-time greats. Back to Earth. After the White House, election to Cooperstown may be the next most coveted national honor. Membership in the Baseball Hall of Fame is determined by an election. There is a group of eligible candidates. A player with 10 years of experience becomes eligible 5 years after retirement. The electors are the members of the Baseball Writers Association. Each voter may vote for up to 10 candidates. All candidates capturing votes from more than 75% of the total number of ballots returned are elected. As you would now expect, a problem with this system is that the electors don't have the right incentives to vote for their true preferences. The rule that limits each voter to 10 choices forces the voters to consider electability as well as merit. You might think that 10 votes are enough, but remember, there are around 30 candidates on the ballot. Some sports writers may believe a candidate is deserving, but they don't want to throw away the vote if the player is unlikely to make the cutoff. This same issue arose for voting in presidential primaries, and it appears in any election in which each voter is given a fixed number of votes to distribute among the candidates. Two experts in game theory propose an alternative way to run elections. Stephen Brams and Peter Fishburne, one a political scientist and the other an economist, argue that approval voting allows voters to express their true preferences without concern for electability. Under approval voting, each voter may vote for as many candidates as he wishes. Voting for one person does not exclude voting for any number of others. Thus, there is no harm in voting for a candidate who has no hope of winning. Of course, if people can vote for as many candidates as they wish, who gets elected? Like the Cooperstown rule, the electoral rule could specify in advance a percentage of the vote needed to win. Or it could pre-specify the number of winning candidates, and then the positions are filled by those who gather the greatest number of votes. Approval voting has begun to catch on and is used by many professional societies. How would it work for the Baseball Hall of Fame? Would Congress do better if it used approval voting when deciding which expenditure projects should be included in the annual budget? We look at the strategic issues associated with approval voting when a cutoff percentage determines the winners. Imagine that election to the different sports halls of fame was decided by approval voting, in which all candidates capturing above a fixed percentage of the votes are elected. At first glance, the voters have no incentive to misstate their preferences. The candidates are not in competition with one another, but only with an absolute standard of quality implicit in the rule that specifies the required percentage of approval. If I think Mark McGwire should be in the Baseball Hall of Fame, I can only reduce his chances by withholding my approval, and if I think he doesn't belong there, I can only make his admission more likely by voting contrary to my view. However, candidates may compete against one another in the voters' minds, even though nothing in the rules mandates it. This will usually happen because voters have preferences concerning the size or the structure of the membership. Suppose Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa come up for election to the Baseball Hall of Fame. I think McGwire is the better hitter, although I will admit that Sosa also meets the standard for a Hall of Fame berth. However, I think it most important that two sluggers not be elected in the same year. My guess is that the rest of the electorate regards Sosa more highly, and he would get in no matter how I vote, but that McGwire's case will be a close call, and my approval is likely to tip him over. Voting truthfully means naming McGwire, which is likely to lead to the outcome in which both are admitted. Therefore, I have the incentive to misstate my preference and vote for Sosa. If this seems a bit convoluted, it is. That's the type of reasoning that would be required for people to act strategically under approval voting. It is possible, though unlikely. A similar problem arises if two players complement each other, rather than compete with each other, in the voters' minds. I may think neither Jeff Boycott nor Sunil Gavaskar belongs in the Cricket Hall of Fame, but it would be a gross injustice to have one and not the other. If, in my judgment, the rest of the electorate would choose Boycott, even if I don't vote for him, while my vote may be crucial in deciding Gavaskar's selection, then I have an incentive to misstate my preference and vote for Gavaskar. In contrast, a quota rule explicitly places candidates in competition with one another. Suppose the Baseball Hall of Fame limits admission to only 2 new people each year. Let each voter be given 2 votes. He can divide them between 2 candidates or give both to the same candidate. The candidates' votes are totaled and the top 2 are admitted. Now suppose there are 3 candidates, Joe DiMaggio, Marv Throneberry, and Bob Uecker. Everyone rates DiMaggio at the top, but the electors are split equally between the other 2. I know that DiMaggio is sure to get in, so as a Marv Throneberry fan, I give my 2 votes to him to increase his chances over Bob Uecker. Of course, everyone else is equally subtle. The result, Throneberry and Uecker are elected, and DiMaggio gets no votes. Government expenditure projects naturally compete with one another so long as the total budget is limited or congressmen and senators have strong preferences over the size of the budget. We will leave you to think which, if any, is the DiMaggio project and which ones are the Throneberries and Uecker's of federal spending. Love a loathed enemy. The incentive to distort one's preferences is a common problem. One instance occurs when you can move first and use this opportunity to influence others. Take, for example, the case of charitable contributions by foundations. Suppose there are 2 foundations, each with a budget of $250,000. They are presented with 3 grant applications, one from an organization helping the homeless, one from the University of Michigan, and one from Yale. Both foundations agree that a grant of $200,000 to the homeless is the top priority. Of the 2 other applications, the first foundation would like to see more money go to Michigan, while the second would prefer to fund Yale. Suppose the second steals a march and sends a check for its total budget, $250,000, to Yale. The first is then left with no alternative but to provide $200,000 to the homeless, leaving only $50,000 for Michigan. If the 2 foundations had split the grant to the homeless, then Michigan would have received $150,000, as would Yale. Thus, the second foundation has engineered a transfer of $100,000 from Michigan to Yale through the homeless. In a sense, the foundation has distorted its preferences. It has not given anything to its top charity priority. But their strategic commitment does serve its true interests. In fact, this type of funding game is quite common. By acting first, small foundations exercise more influence over which secondary priorities get funded. Large foundations, and especially the federal government, are then left to fund the most pressing needs. A similar example is the strategic interaction played between the Marshall and Rhodes scholarships. The Marshall scholarship moves second via a waitlist and thereby has the maximum influence over who is given a scholarship to study in England. If someone has the potential to win both a Marshall and a Rhodes, the Marshall scholarship allows the person to study as a Rhodes scholar. That brings the person to England at no cost to the Marshall scholarship, and thus allows them to select one more person. This strategic rearranging of priorities has a direct parallel with voting. Before the 1974 Budget Act, Congress employed many of the same tricks. Unimportant expenditures were voted on and approved first. Later on, when the crunch appeared, the remaining expenditures were too important to be denied. To solve this problem, Congress now votes first on budget totals and then works within them. When you can rely on others to save you later, you have an incentive to distort your priorities by exaggerating your claim and taking advantage of the other's preferences. You might be willing to gain at the expense of putting something you want at risk, if you can count on someone else bearing the cost of the rescue. Case study: The Tie of Power. Recent presidential elections have emphasized the importance of the selection of the vice president. This person will be just a heartbeat away from the presidency. But most candidates for president spurn the suggestion of the second spot on the ticket, and most vice presidents do not seem to enjoy the experience. Only one clause of the Constitution specifies any actual activity for the vice president. Article 1, Section 3.4 says, "The vice president of the United States shall be president of the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they be equally divided." The presiding is ceremony, idle ceremony, and most of the time the vice president delegates this responsibility to a rotation of junior senators chosen by the Senate majority leader. Is the tie-breaking vote important, or is it just more ceremony? Case discussion. At first glance, both logic and evidence seem to support the ceremonial viewpoint. The vice president's vote just does not seem important. The chance of a tie vote is small. The most favorable circumstances for a tie arise when each senator is just as likely to vote one way as the other, and an even number of senators vote. The result will be roughly one tie vote in 12. The biggest chance that a fixed group of 50 senators votes aye and the remaining 50 vote nay is 1/2 to the 50th power times 1/2 to the 50th power. Multiplying this by the number of waves of finding 50 supporters out of the total 100, we get approximately 1/12. Of course, senators' votes are far from random. Only when the two parties are roughly equal, or when there is an especially divisive issue that splits some of the party lines, does the vice president's vote get counted. The most active tie-breaking vice president was our first, John Adams. He cast 29 tie-breaking votes during his 8 years. This is not surprising, since his Senate consisted of only 20 members, and a tie was almost 3 times more likely than it is today with our 100-member Senate. In fact, over the first 218 years, there have been only 243 occasions for the vice president to vote. Richard Nixon, under Eisenhower, tied for the most active 20th century vice president, casting a total of 8 tie-breaking votes out of 1,229 decisions reached by the Senate during the period 1953 to 1961. This fall in tie-breaking votes also reflects the fact that the two-party system is much more entrenched, so that fewer issues are likely to cross party lines. But this ceremonial picture of the vice president's vote is misleading. More important than how often the vice president votes is the impact of the vote. Measured correctly, the vice president's vote is roughly equal in importance to that of any senator. One reason the vice president's vote matters is that it tends to decide only the most important and divisive issues. For example, George H.W. Bush's vote as vice president saved the MX missile program, and with it helped hasten the collapse of the Soviet Union. This suggests that we should look more closely at just when it is that a vote matters. A vote can have one of two effects. It can be instrumental in determining the outcome, or it can be a voice that influences the margin of victory or defeat without altering the outcome. In a decision-making body like the Senate, the first aspect is the more important one. To demonstrate the importance of the vice president's current position, imagine that the vice president is given a regular vote as president of the Senate. When does this have any additional impact? For important issues, all 100 senators will try to be present. The only time the outcome hinges on the vice president's 101st vote is when the Senate is split 50-50, just the same as when the vice president has only a tie-breaking vote. The best example of this is the 107th Congress during the first George W. Bush administration. The Senate was evenly split, 50-50. Thus, Vice President Cheney's tie-breaking vote gave the Republicans control of the Senate. All 50 Republican senators were pivotal. If anyone had been replaced, control would have shifted to the Democrats. We recognize that our account of a vice president's voting power leaves out aspects of reality. Some of these imply less power for the vice president, others more. Much of a senator's power comes from the work in committees, in which the vice president does not partake. On the other hand, the vice president has the ear and the veto power of the president on his side. Our illustration of the vice president's vote leads to an important moral of wider applicability. Anyone's vote affects the outcome only when it creates or breaks a tie. Think how important your own vote is in different contexts. How influential can you be in a presidential election? Your town's mayoral election? Your club's secretarial election? The shark repellent that backfired, in Chapter 14, offers another case study on voting. Chapter 13. Incentives. Why did the socialist economic systems fail so miserably? The best-laid five-year plans of Stalin and his successors, Gang Agley, because the workers and the managers lacked adequate incentives. Most importantly, the system offered no reward for doing a good job rather than a merely adequate one. People had no reason to show initiative or innovation, and every reason to cut corners wherever they could, fulfilling quantity quotas and slacking on quality, for example. In the old Soviet economy, this was captured by the quip, "They only pretend to pay us, so we only pretend to work." A market economy has a better natural incentive mechanism, namely the profit motive. A company that succeeds in cutting costs or introducing a new product makes a greater profit. One that lags behind stands to lose money. But even this does not work perfectly. Each employee or manager in a company is not fully exposed to the chill wind of competition in the market, and the top management of the firm has to devise its own internal carrots and sticks to obtain the desired standards of performance from those below. When two firms join forces for a particular project, they have the added problem of designing a contract that will share the incentives between them in the right way. We develop the components required for a smart incentive scheme through a series of examples. Incentives for effort. Of all the steps involved in writing a book, surely the most tedious for an author is the correction of the printer's proofs. For readers unfamiliar with the process, let us briefly explain what that entails. The printer sets the type from the final manuscript. These days, this is done electronically and is therefore relatively error-free. But strange errors, missing words and lines, chunks of text shifted to wrong places, bad line and page breaks, may still creep in. Moreover, this is the author's last chance to correct any slips of writing or even of thinking. Therefore, the author has to read the printer's copy in parallel with his own manuscript and locate and mark all errors for the typesetter to correct. The author is reading the same text for the umpteenth time, so it is not surprising that his eyes glaze over and he misses several errors. Therefore, it is better to hire someone, typically a student in our case, to do the proofreading. A good student can not only catch the typographical errors, but also spot and alert the author to more substantive errors of writing and thinking. But hiring a student to read proofs brings its own problems. The authors have a natural incentive to make the book as error-free as possible. The student is less motivated. Therefore, it becomes necessary to give the student the correct incentives, usually by paying him in relation to how well he does the job. The author wants the student to catch all the typesetting errors there may be. But the only way the author can tell whether the student has done a perfect job is to do a perfect check himself, which defeats the whole purpose of hiring the student. The student's effort is unobservable. He takes away the materials and comes back a week or so later to give the author a list of the errors he has found. What is worse, even the outcome cannot be observed immediately. The author will find out about any error that the student failed to catch only when some other reader, such as yourself, finds and reports the errors, which may not happen for several months or even years. So the student has the temptation to shirk, just hold on to the materials for a few days, and then say there were no errors. Thus, it won't do to offer the student a fixed flat sum for the job. But if offered a piece rate, so much per error he finds. He may worry that the typesetter has done a perfect job, in which case he will have to spend a week or more on the work and get no money at the end of it. He will be reluctant to take the job on these terms. We have a problem of information asymmetry, but it is different from the ones we consider in Chapter 8. The author is the informationally disadvantaged party. He cannot observe the student's effort. This is not something innate to the student. It is the student's deliberate choice. Therefore, the problem is not one of adverse selection. Rather, it is similar to the problem that an insured homeowner may be less careful about locking all doors and windows. Of course, insurance companies regard such behavior as almost immoral, and they have coined the term moral hazard to describe it. Economists and game theorists take a more relaxed attitude. They think it perfectly natural that people would respond in their own best interests to the incentives they face. If they can get away with shirking on the job, they will do so. What else should one expect from rational players? The onus is on the other player to design the incentive scheme better. Although moral hazard and adverse selection are different issues, there are some similarities in the methods for coping with them. Just as screening mechanisms have to consider the restrictions of incentive compatibility and participation, so do incentive payment schemes that cope with moral hazard. A fixed sum does not handle the incentive aspect well, whereas a pure piece rate payment does not handle the participation aspect well. Therefore, the compensation scheme has to be a compromise between the two extremes, a flat sum plus a bonus per error the student discovers. This should give him enough assurance of the total compensation to make the job sufficiently attractive and also enough incentive to attempt a thorough reading. One of us, Dixit, recently hired a student to read the proofs of a 600-page book. He offered a fixed payment of $600, a dollar per page, plus the outcome-based incentive of $1 per error found. The student found 274. The work took the student about 70 hours, so the average per hour, $12.49, was quite a decent wage by undergraduate student standards. We don't claim that the scheme was fully optimal or the best deal Avinash could have gotten, and the outcome of the job was quite good but not perfect. About 30 errors the student missed have come to light since. But the example illustrates the general idea of a mixture and how it works in practice. We see the same principle applied in many jobs and contracts. How do you pay a software designer or a copywriter? It is hard to monitor their hours. Is the time spent playing foosball, web surfing, or doodling part of the creative process or just slacking off? Even more important, it is even harder to measure how hard they have worked. The answer is to base part of their compensation on the success of the project and the success of the company, and that can be done using the company's stock or stock options. The principle is to combine a basic salary and an incentive bonus tied to the outcome. The same applies with even greater force to the compensation of higher-level management. Of course, like everything else, these schemes can be manipulated, but the general principle behind their use as incentive payment mechanisms remains valid. Many extensions and applications of this principle have been studied by game theorists, economists, business analysts, psychologists, and others. We will give you a brief taste of some of this work and point you to references where you can pursue the subject as far as you wish. How to write an incentive contract. The main problem of moral hazard is the unobservability of a worker's action or effort. Therefore, payments cannot be based on effort, even though more or better effort is what you, as an employer, want to achieve. Payments must be based on some observable metric, such as the outcome or your profit. If there were a perfect and certain one-to-one relationship between such observable outcomes and the unobservable underlying action, perfect control of effort would be possible. But in practice, outcome depends on other chance factors, not just the effort. For example, the profits of an insurance company depend on its sales force and claim agents, the pricing, and Mother Nature. In a season with many hurricanes, profits will be depressed no matter how hard people work. In fact, they will often have to work harder due to the increased number of claims. The observable outcome is only an imperfect indicator of the unobservable effort. The two are related, and therefore incentive payments based on the outcome are still useful in influencing effort, but they don't work to perfection. Rewarding an employee for a good outcome in part rewards him for good luck, and penalizing him for a poor outcome in part penalizes him for bad luck. If the chance element is too large, the reward is only poorly related to effort, and therefore the effect of outcome-based incentives on effort is weak. Realizing this, you would not offer such incentives to any great extent. Conversely, if the chance element is small, then stronger and sharper incentives can be used. This contrast will appear repeatedly in what follows. Nonlinear incentive schemes. A special feature of many incentive schemes, for example, payment per error found by the proofreader, or a fixed percentage of the sale paid to a salesperson, or payment in stock that constitutes a given fraction of the firm's profit, is their linearity. The incremental payment is strictly proportional to the improvement in the outcome. Other commonly used payment schemes are distinctly nonlinear. The most obvious is a bonus that is paid if the outcome exceeds a specified threshold or an assigned quota. What are the relative merits of a quota and bonus scheme as compared to a linear or proportional compensation scheme? Take the context of a salesman and consider a pure quota bonus scheme. The salesman is paid a low fixed sum if he fails to meet the quota during the year, and a higher fixed sum if he does. First, suppose the quota is set at such a level that by exerting a hard level of effort, he stands a good chance of meeting it, but the chance drops substantially if he slacks off even a little. Then, the bonus provides a powerful incentive. The salesman stands to gain a lot of income or lose a lot, depending on whether he decides to work hard or shirk. But suppose the quota is set at such a demanding level that the salesman has little chance of meeting it, even with superhuman effort. Then he will see no point in exerting himself for the sake of that unlikely bonus. And circumstances may change during the year, turning what you thought was a well-set quota into something too demanding and therefore ineffective. For example, suppose that the quota for the full year is not absurdly high, but the salesman has some bad luck in the first half of the year, making it unlikely that he would meet the year's quota in the 6 months that remain. That would cause him to give up and take things easy for the rest of the year, which is surely not what the employer wants. Conversely, if the salesman gets lucky and meets the quota in June, again he can relax for the rest of the year. There is no added reward to any further effort in that year. In fact, the salesman could conspire with some customers to postpone their orders to the next year to give him a good start toward next year's quota. Again, that is hardly in your interests. This illustrates in an extreme form the drawbacks of many nonlinear payment schemes. They have to be designed just right. Otherwise, their incentives may be ineffective, and they are prone to manipulation. Linear schemes may not give extra incentives at just the right points, but they are much more robust to changing circumstances and misuse. In practice, combinations of linear and nonlinear schemes are often used. For example, salespeople usually get a percentage commission in addition to a bonus for achieving a given quota. And there may be larger bonuses for achieving further thresholds, such as 150% or 200% of the base quota. Such mixtures can achieve some of the useful purposes of the quota without risking the larger drawbacks. Trip to the gym number 9. The typical real estate agent commission is 6%, which is a linear incentive. How much of an incentive does your agent have to get a higher price? What would an extra $20,000 in the price bring in? Hint: the answer is not $1,200. How would you design a better incentive scheme? What might be some of the issues with your alternative scheme? Carrots versus sticks. An incentive payment scheme has two key aspects. The average payment to the worker, which must be enough to fulfill the participation constraint, and the spread of payments in good versus bad outcomes, which is what provides the incentive to exert more or better effort. The bigger the spread, the more powerful the incentive. Even holding the spread constant, the incentive scheme can be designed as either a carrot or a stick. Imagine that the spread is 50 and the average payment is 100. Under a carrot reward scheme, the employee would get, for example, 99 most of the time and 149 in the event of exceptional performance. The required output for the exceptional performance reward is set so high that the chance of hitting this target is only 2%, assuming the worker puts forth the desired amount of effort. Conversely, under a stick reward scheme, the employee would get 101 almost all the time, but a punishment of 51 in the event of exceptionally poor performance. Here, the bar for poor performance is set so low that the chance of hitting it is only 2%, assuming the desired level of effort is provided. Although the schemes feel quite different, both the spread and the average payments are the same. The average is determined by the participation constraint, and therefore, in turn, by how much the worker could have earned in opportunities other than this employment. The employer wants to keep the payment to the worker low so as to increase his own profit. He may deliberately seek agents with poor alternatives, but workers who come for such low average payments may have low skills. An adverse selection problem may raise its ugly head. In some cases, the employer may have strategies that deliberately reduce the worker's alternatives. That is exactly what Stalin attempted. The Soviet state did not pay its workers very well, even when they performed well. But if they didn't, they went to Siberia. They could not escape from the country. They had no outside opportunities. This could have been a good incentive scheme in the sense that it provided powerful incentives and was cheap to operate. But it failed because the punishment scheme wasn't closely tied to effort. People found that they might be denounced and punished almost as easily if they worked hard or shirked, so they did not have the incentive to work hard after all. Luckily, private employers and even the state in modern democracies lack these arbitrary powers to reduce the workers' alternative opportunities. But think of the compensation schemes of CEOs in this light. It seems that CEOs gain huge sums as incentive rewards if their companies do well on their watch, but they get only slightly less huge sums if the companies just do okay, and a golden parachute if the company actually fails on their watch. The average of these large sums, calculated using the probabilities of the possible outcomes, must be greatly above what is truly needed to induce these people to take the jobs. In the theory's jargon, their participation constraints appear to be grossly overfulfilled. The reason for this is competition for the CEO candidates. Compared to the alternative of driving a cab or retiring early to play golf, the pay is well more than what is needed to keep the person working. But if another company is willing to guarantee $10 million no matter what happens, then the participation constraint with your company is not compared with driving a taxi or playing golf, but with taking a $10 million CEO package elsewhere. In Europe, where CEO pay is generally much lower, companies are still able to hire and motivate CEOs. The lower pay still beats playing golf, and because many candidates are unwilling to move their families to the United States, the relevant participation constraint is with the other European companies. The many dimensions of incentive payment schemes. We have so far emphasized a single task, such as reading the proofs of a book or selling a product. In reality, each context where incentive schemes are used has multiple dimensions. Many tasks, many workers, even many workers engaged simultaneously in the same or similar tasks, and many years before the outcome is fully known. Incentive schemes must take into account the interactions among all these dimensions. This makes for some difficult analysis, but some simple ideas emerge. Let us look at some of them. Career concerns. When the job is expected to last for several years, the worker may be motivated in the early years not by immediate cash or stock payments, but by the prospect of future salary increases and promotions, that is, by incentives that extend over the full career. Such considerations are stronger for people who have longer futures with the company ahead of them. They are less useful for workers near retirement, and not very useful for youngsters who are just starting out in the labor market and expect to move and change jobs a few times before settling on a career. Promotion incentives are most useful for younger employees at lower and middle levels. To use an example from our experience, assistant professors are motivated to do research by the prospects of tenure and promotion much more than they are by immediate salary increases within the rank. In the example of the student reading the proofs of the professor's book, a longer-term interaction may exist because the professor is supervising the student's research, or the student will need letters of recommendation from the professor in the future for jobs where similar skills are relevant. These career concerns make immediate cash incentive less important. The student will do a good job for the sake of the implicit future rewards, closer attention to his research, and better letters of recommendation. These aspects don't even have to be spelled out explicitly by the professor. Everyone in the environment understands the larger game being played. Repeated relationships. Another aspect of ongoing employment is that the same worker performs similar actions repeatedly. Each time there is an element of chance that makes the outcome an inaccurate indicator of the effort, so incentives cannot be perfect. But if luck at different times is independent, then by the law of large numbers, the average output is a more accurate measure of average effort. This makes more powerful incentives possible. The idea is that the employer may believe the employee's hard luck story once, the claim of persistent bad luck is less plausible. Efficiency wages. You are considering hiring someone for a job in your firm. This job requires careful effort, and good work would be worth $60,000 a year to you. The worker would rather take things easy. He suffers some mental or even physical cost in exerting effort. The worker's subjective valuation of this cost is $8,000 per year. You need to pay enough to entice the worker to your company and pay in a way that induces careful effort. There are dead-end jobs requiring no special effort that pay $40,000. You need to beat that. In terms of motivating effort, you cannot observe directly whether the worker is exerting careful effort or not. If he does not, there is some chance that things will go wrong in a way you will notice. Suppose the probability of this is 25%. What incentive payment will induce the worker to put in the requisite effort? You can offer a contract of the following kind. I will pay you some amount above your other opportunities so long as no shirking on your part comes to light. But if that ever happens, I will fire you and spread the word of your misbehavior among all the other employers, with the result that you will never earn anything more than the basic $40,000 again. How high does the salary have to be so that the risk of losing it will deter the worker from cheating? Clearly, you will have to pay him more than $48,000. Otherwise, the worker will only take your job if he plans to shirk. The question is how much more. We will call the extra amount X for a total salary of $48,000 plus X. That means the worker is X better off at your job compared to the alternative. Suppose the worker does cheat 1 year. In that year, he will not have to incur the subjective cost of effort, so he will have gained the equivalent of $8,000. But he will run a 25% risk of being found out and losing X dollars this year and every year after that. Is the one-time gain of $8,000 worth the prospective loss of 0.25X every year thereafter? That depends on how money at different times is compared, that is, on the interest rate. Suppose the interest rate is 10%. Then getting an extra X annually is like owning a bond with a face value of 10X dollars, which at 10% pays X annually. The immediate gain of the equivalent of $8,000 should be compared with the 25% chance of losing $10x dollars. If $8,000 is less than 0.25 times 10x, the worker will calculate that he should not shirk. This means x dollars is greater than $8,000 divided by 2.5 equals $3,200. If you offer the worker an annual salary of $48,000 plus $3,200 equals $51,200, so long as no shirking comes to light, he will not in fact shirk. It isn't worth risking the extra $3,200 forever in order to slack off and get a quick $8,000 this year. And since good effort is worth $60,000 per year to you, it is in your interest to offer this higher wage. The purpose of the wage is to get the worker to put in the requisite effort and work more efficiently, and so it is called an efficiency wage. The excess above the basic wage elsewhere, which is $11,200 in our example, is called the efficiency premium. The principle behind the efficiency wage enters your daily life at many points. If you go to the same car mechanic regularly, you would do well to pay a little more than the lowest rate for the job. The prospect of the steady extra profit will deter the mechanic from cheating you. You are paying him a premium, not for efficiency in this case, but for honesty. To fill out the analogy, imagine that the mechanic can invent a problem that brings him $1,000 of extra profits, which, at a 10% interest rate, is like an extra $100 per year. However, there is a 25% chance that you will catch him, in which case you will never return to this garage. If your future business will bring in more than $400 of profit every year, then he would rather play it straight than risk losing your future business and the profits that go with it. Multiple tasks. Employees usually perform multiple tasks. To take an example close to home, professors teach and carry out research. In such cases, the incentives for the different tasks can interact. The overall effect depends on whether the tasks are substitutes, in the sense that when the worker devotes more effort to one task, the net productivity of effort on the other task suffers, or complements, in the sense that more effort to one task raises the net productivity of the effort devoted to the other task. Think of a farmhand working in the cornfields and in the dairy. The more he works on corn, the more tired he will get, and each hour he spends in the dairy will be less productive. Conversely, think of a farm worker who looks after beehives and apple orchards. The more effort he puts into beekeeping, the more productive his effort in growing apples. When tasks are substitutes, giving strong incentives to each kind of effort hurts the outcome of the other. Therefore, both incentives have to be kept weaker than you would think if you considered each task in isolation. But when tasks are mutual complements, incentives to induce better effort on each task help the outcome of the other. Then the owner can make both incentives strong to take advantage of these synergies without having to worry about any dysfunctional interactions. This has ramifications for organization design. Suppose you want to get many tasks performed. You should try, to the extent possible, to assign them to the employees in such a way that each performs a set of tasks that complement one another. In the same way, a big enterprise should be structured into divisions, each of which is responsible for a subset of mutually complementary tasks, and substitute tasks should be assigned to different divisions. That way, you can take advantage of strong incentives for each employee and within each division. The consequences of failing to follow this rule can be seen by everyone who has ever flown to or through London's Heathrow Airport. The function of an airport is to receive departing passengers at the curbside and deliver them to their airplanes, and receive arriving passengers from their airplanes and deliver them to their ground transport. All the activities that occur in each of these processes, check-in, security, shopping, and so on, are complements. Conversely, multiple airports serving a city are mutual substitutes, albeit not perfect ones. They differ in their locations relative to the city, the ground transport facilities to which they are connected, and so on. The principle of grouping together complementary activities and separating substitute activities says that all the functions within one airport should be under the control of one management, and then different airports should compete with each other for the airlines and the passengers' business. The UK government has done exactly the